Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
So that's Sonny Stitt with the song Flying Home. Flying Home. At the Hi-Hat in Boston, 1954, there was a time when the hi-hat was the high point of jazz performance in Boston, and there was a time when it was all white, except for the workers. Then came Wally's. In 1947, Joseph L. Walcott opened the club. It quickly became famous among black musicians and patrons. If you were Dizzy Gillespie or Cannonball Adderley, you played Wally's. The hi-hat noticed and eventually changed its admission policies. Now, the hi-hat eventually closed, but Wally's didn't, even after a pandemic shutdown. In fact, the nearly 80-year-old club just reopened its doors for live audiences for the first time since 2020. And in this installment of The Business of Boston, we are looking at what you can hear at Wally's this weekend and 7 days a week. Frank Poindexter is the general manager, part owner of Wally's Cafe Jazz Club. Frank, welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
When we last talked to you, September of 2020, you were worried about lost revenue for 6 months, thinking about how to make it through. How does it feel to be open?
Oh, man, we're so pleased to be back open. It's been a long 2.5 years. And, I mean, it really makes you appreciate, you know, being able to do what you do, meeting the young musicians, great customers, and just providing a really good service to the city of Boston and the surrounding New England community.
So there's so much I want to talk to you about with you in this time, and I want to do a little history first. So your grandfather was Joseph Wally Walcott, who opened Wally's. You, your two siblings, your mom, Eleanor, now run it. What is your earliest memory of Wally's?
Well, my earliest memory of Wally's is actually across the street in our original location, and that would be working in the basement with my grandfather, Mr. Walcott, and we used to have to sort the beer bottles so that they can be returned back to the companies.
How old were you?
Probably like about six or seven years old.
And you're sorting beer bottles in the basement.
Exactly.
I bet there were a lot of them.
A lot of them, exactly. It was a lot bigger venue back then.
And have you worked basically at Wally's?
Ever since. That's basically what I've done. I mean, I've had a few odd and end jobs, but for the most part, since I left school in 84, I've been in Wally's.
All right. So producer Amanda Beeland put a lot of love into getting lots of music to kind of situate us in this world of jazz in Boston. We couldn't find early recordings from Wally's, although we know many of the jazz greats came through. So we've got some sound from other places. So here is Artie Shaw, his orchestra. This is at the Ritz in Boston with the song Comes Love. So that's 1939 when that song came out.
Yes.
When your grandfather opens Wally's, jazz is being generated, pushed forward by black musicians, but it is white patrons who are going to see it. And was it tilting at windmills? Did people think he was tilting at windmills when he opened Wally's?
Well, he did, but, you know, fortunately, my grandfather, who was a Barbadian immigrant, had a diverse network. And so with the help of Gabriel Piemonte, he was an attorney, but he was the longest serving Boston City Council president. And also with the help of Mayor Curley, you know, he was able to become one of the first African Americans to get a liquor license in the state of Massachusetts. So, you know, he had a diverse network. And also he was able to secure a lot of talent from New York and through the whole Chitlin circuit, which many African-American musicians had to, you know, use that network in order to get gigs up and down the East Coast and on the West Coast. And so with the help of Ed Smalls, who was a famous bar owner in Harlem, and his connections, you know, just throughout Harlem, through that whole African-American, you know, business network, he was able to secure talent. And so, you know, from there, he was able to open the club. And one of the primary things he did was enable that we could integrate the clubs in Boston, in New England, was he went to the colleges. So Harvard, Boston University, Boston College, and the other surrounding colleges, and he advertised. And so those young people were the impetus of, you know, the integration of the surrounding black community and then the young kids, you know, who enjoy jazz. And so that helped integrate the nightclub scene in Boston.
So let's hear a little more of this is 1954. This is from Storyville Nightclub in Boston. This is Lee Konitz, jazz saxophonist, If I Had You. So I've come to love jazz over the last few years, but a lot of people still don't understand in the 30s, 40s, 50s, what an engine of creativity jazz was. Listen to this and talk about this, the creativity of that era.
Again, you know something, what it really comes down to is you're taking an inanimate object and you're making that inanimate object do something that is creative. It's different than, you know, using, you know, electronic instruments and stuff like that. You know, you really had to actually practice and practice for hours and hours and days in order to be able to master, you know, these instruments. And the other thing was that those skills they're transferable. So, you know, I mean, the level of focus, you know, it's like nowadays you see our young people, they may have a short attention spans and stuff like that. But, you know, in those times you had to read. You had to read books, you know what I'm saying? We weren't able to look at screens. You didn't have the enormous amount of information which can distract children. So, you know, distract people, children or whoever, you know what I'm saying? So
distracts me, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know what I'm saying? You had to focus, and it was really about mastery of whatever you're doing, you know what I'm saying? And
speaking of mastery, you've been in Wally's since you were 6 or 7 years old.
Yes.
What's the most remarkable performance you've ever seen there?
Roy Hargrove. Passed away about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but, you know, some people are just blessed with certain, you know, innate talents, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, I equate it to basketball. If you're seeing Kobe Bryant play basketball or Larry Bird, Bill Russell, you know, some people have these innate talents that they're born with, and then they are able to, you know, work their craft and master their craft. And so when I was able to see Roy Hargrove play, like he just, you know, usually getting students, but he had already had a mastery of his instrument. And he was able to do things with the instrument that ordinary people couldn't do.
Trumpet player.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, all right. So last year, Boston Magazine put together an oral history of Wally's. Here's what Boston jazz historian Richard Vaca said about the club. Quote, "When Wally's opened, there were already 2 jazz clubs on that block, but both were owned by white guys. So I think it was really important from a neighborhood point of view, maybe from a pride point of view, that here was the first time that a nightclub in New England was owned and operated by a black guy. This was finally a place where people could get together and relax without having to worry about admissions criteria or any of that kind of stuff. In other words, they could be served." So I'm going to put that in some perspective, right? We've talked about a few of the different jazz clubs. We took the Ritz, the Hi-Hat. Here's a little bit of sound from a jazz club in Peabody, March 1971. It's Miles Davis at Lenny's on the Turnpike. And we actually couldn't find the name of the song, but here it is. Okay, and for people who don't know, Miles Davis in the 70s was a very different kind of musician than
exactly.
Miles Davis in the, you know, earlier decades.
That's right.
But many of these places are gone. Wally's isn't, which means that given its start, how have you stayed so relevant, especially where jazz has gone less mainstream over time?
Well, the first thing is that we as a family business, we're committed to what we do, and we're committed to our grandfather's legacy. And then the other thing is that, you know, we're in Boston, and our location is centrally located, two blocks south of Boston Symphony Hall. But the most important thing is that we are surrounded by some of the greatest institutions for training musicians. So you have New England Conservatory, you got Boston Conservatory, you got Berklee College of Music, Harvard University, Boston University, Northeastern University. So in terms of training musicians, this is a special location. You really don't get this any other place. You might, you know, you have in New York, you have Juilliard, the New School, but any other place on the planet, this is it. So we're getting, at this time, due to Berklee primarily, you're getting the most talented young people from across the globe coming here to train to be musicians. And they not just musicians, they could be sound engineers, they could be songwriters, you know, they could be just studying music business, but you're getting the most talented people on the planet, young people. And the network that, you know, primarily through Berklee that has grown, it touches every part of the music industry. And so we're fortunate to be able to have a forum where these young people can practice and perfect their craft.
So I just have to notice that we have a Berklee graduate sound engineer behind the board in our control room today.
That's right.
Hey, Michaela, so to your point. All right, so that does bring us to today. So you had to shut down. Everybody had to shut down.
That's right.
You were waiting to kind of figure out whether phase four with limited attendance was going to allow you to open back up. You wound up going virtual, streaming performances.
Yes.
Was it enough to stay alive, or have you had to work miracles to keep things going?
Well, the thing is that, you know, due to the help of the federal government, they, you know, implemented different plans. So we were able to participate in the Save Our Venues grant. We also were helped by the MGCC, which is a organization in Massachusetts, and through state and local helps. And I was also did a GoFundMe campaign. So through all of that assistance, we were able to maintain our business and then be able to reopen, you know, at an appropriate time. See, since we had such a small location, you had to be careful of the fluctuants coming out of all the instruments. So we were in a unique position. So we couldn't really just open up because we would have exposed our customers to possibly catching COVID.
And because we're talking about wind instruments.
Yes, exactly. And so the most important thing for us is the safety of our customers and the safety of, you know,
So let's play a little bit here. This is from one of the virtual performances. So this is Armir Lee Quintet. This is 2021. And again, we don't have the name of the song on this one, but it is from your streaming. So is this part of the future of Wally's? Will streaming performances always be what you do now in
Well,
the park?
We are really ready to work that program due to the, you know, nature of our customer base and the young musicians. See, we got teams of musicians from all across the planet. We got the European kids from France, Germany, England, Italy. Then we got our Middle East teams from Israel and the surrounding countries. And then we got our Asian acts, you know, Asian musicians from South Korea, China, Japan. And so, you know, again, because Berklee is bringing in students from across the planet, you know, we're able to help these kids develop their craft. And then their supporters and their family members want to see them be able to perform and grow as musicians. So we're, through the help of YouTube, and specifically Ted Katzenberger, who's, he has the independent venue music association within YouTube. They donated equipment to us. And so we're working now to implement that whole thing so we can, you know, stream music. Because we have three bands a day. And, you know, we want to make some exposure for these young people.
Let's talk about that. We've got about a minute left, and we are speaking with Frank Poindexter, who's the general manager and a co-owner of Wally's Cafe Jazz Club here. You've got a seven-day-a-week schedule.
Exactly.
Three bands a day. So you've got Monday blues, Tuesday, Wednesday funk, Thursday Latin jazz, salsa, Friday, Saturday jazz, Sunday back to funk.
Yes.
Do we have that many musicians to play in Boston?
We got more than enough musicians. I mean, it's so many musicians and so many people trying to develop their craft that we don't even have enough slots in order to be able to, you know, help these young people who want to, you know, work on their craft. So, I mean, again, this is one of the most important locations for training musicians on the planet Earth, okay? And so the number of musicians we have here is innumerable. And you know, these young people are just working on their craft. So, I mean, we wish we had more slots.
So what time does Wally's open today?
Today we open at 5 p.m.
And where can people find out more information?
Oh, man, www.wallyscafe.com.
All right. Frank Poindexter is general manager and one of the owners of Wally's Cafe Jazz Club in the South End, a business of Boston that's been with us since 1947. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.